the deal of the century, the Trump so-called peace plan, which the Israelis and the United States of America claim will bring peace to the Middle East, but the Palestinians outright reject and say is an attack on their national identity as well as their land. I'm Robert Inlakesh, and I've come here to occupied Palestine to investigate what the so-called deal of the century means for the Palestinian people and the future of Palestine.
Following the official release of the controversial plan proposed to end the Palestine-Israel conflict, an escalation of violence ensued in occupied Palestine as Israeli occupation forces brutally attacked Palestinian demonstrators, only to strengthen the resolve of the Palestinian national resistance. Being on the ground in Palestine, I lived through this round of violence, witnessing vivid scenes of brutality, racist hate crimes, and the murder of Palestinians. But before we investigate this further, we have to first look at the past to understand how things got to where they are today. The peace process between Palestinians and Israelis, as it is often referred to, was officially initiated with the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993. When PLO leader Yasser Arafat signed the agreement with the Israelis, it was supposed to lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state and the ending of hostilities between Palestinians and Israelis. However, a Palestinian state, as well as peace in the Middle East, never came. Instead, the Oslo Accords had meant for the newly established Palestinian Authority that they had accepted an exclusively Jewish ethno-state on 78% of their historic homeland and received nothing in return. 5 years after the signing of the Oslo Accords, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza was even more deeply entrenched as Israeli settlements expanded on Palestinian land. The only difference on the ground, as peace talks had been ongoing, was that there had been further theft of Palestinian West Bank resources, the besiegement of Gaza, and the bombardment of the Gaza Strip. All of this whilst the Palestinian Authority, based in Ramallah, had acted to protect Israeli security interests. Then, following the second Palestinian uprising in 2000, the illegal separation wall was later built in 2002 in the West Bank, usurping approximately 10% of the territory, also collectively punishing 150 Palestinian communities who were disconnected from their lands, according to the human rights group B'Tselem. Settlements continued expanding and the further confiscation of land and resources from Palestinians ensued, with illegal religious extremist Israeli settlers seizing Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem as well as in the West Bank, all of this being justified by the Israeli claim the Palestinian terrorists had to be subdued and Israel's security had to be protected. Now, Donald Trump's self-proclaimed roadmap to peace would essentially allow for Israel to take half of the West Bank, annexing the most fertile agricultural lands, aquifers, and prohibiting Palestinians from having an army or any real autonomy. It would also connect Palestinian Bantustans together via underground tunnels. Upon arriving in occupied Palestine, I had traveled to the village of Kafin near Tulkarm, where an unarmed 19-year-old boy named Badr was shot in the neck and killed by Israeli occupation forces for protesting against the deal of the century. Unfortunately, this was not the last funeral that I attended of young people and children who had been murdered in the West Bank. However, they all resembled each other roughly. Palestinian family members grieving, the look of disbelief on a broken mother's face, and the cries from the village for a day where the martyrdom of their brother or sister will enable a free Jerusalem al-Quds, a belief that gives meaning to the life of those martyred. Al-Quds is at the heart of every Palestinian. It is holy to both Muslim and Christian Palestinians who are currently unable to visit if they live in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, or Palestinian diaspora. The international consensus for a solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict states that East Jerusalem is to be the capital of the future Palestinian state. This, however, is not what is being allocated to the Palestinians under the Trump-Netanyahu vision. Instead, they are confining the capital of the Palestinian people to outside the separation walls of Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
I'm standing here in Abu Dis, the proposed capital for the Palestinian people. And of course, Abu Dis here is a suburb just outside of mainland Jerusalem, Al-Quds. And what we see here in Abu Dis is the apartheid system in the West Bank at its most clearest. We see over here behind us Palestinian villages, Jerusalemites, separated from their brethren and their lands on the other side of the wall over here. People who have been separated so that they cannot see their family members, that they cannot come and farm their lands, and of course separated by this wall. If this was to be accepted as the capital of Palestine, that would mean not only would it be this little slither of land, which would not include the old city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, but it means that it will be a symbol of the oppression of the Palestinian people. And for them to live like this, seeing every single day what could have been, and Jerusalem, Al-Quds, with Masjid al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rocks in the background, is utter pain and struggle.
This separation of Jerusalemite Muslims and Christians from Jerusalem al-Quds is rarely ever shown on mainstream Western television, and so before you travel to the West Bank, one would imagine that the situation is completely different from the reality faced here. What my cameraman and I witnessed on the Palestinian side of Israel's wall was the humiliation of Palestinians on a daily basis, and a space allocated for a capital which would hardly drive tourism to a country with its depressing scenery, bringing with it a feeling of walking around in an open-air prison. Even on the other side of the wall, Palestinian homes are constantly being demolished and stolen by Israeli settlers, as Donald Trump emboldens their actions with the decree that Israel's undivided capital is to be Jerusalem al-Quds. The justification given by Israel for such disturbing realities imposed on the ground is that what has been imposed is for Israel's security. But even if that was the truth behind the occupation and violations of international law, this excuse was not accepted internationally by the court of public opinion when it came to apartheid South African whites. So why is it reasonable coming from Israeli Jews, I ask? But the issue of division isn't the only problem facing the Palestinians. There is also the problem of where the two divided peoples would live if remaining segregated, and where any viable borders could possibly exist between Palestinians and the Israelis. The issues of borders is of course made tough due to the Israeli illegal racial colonies, or settlements as they're referred to.
Something that you cannot escape when you come here to the West Bank is seeing and witnessing how deeply entrenched these settlements are into the Palestinian land here.
Currently, over 750,000 illegal Israeli settlers live on stolen Palestinian land, equating to a land grab of 40% of the West Bank. Due to seizure of land, Palestinians currently live in 165 disconnected islands surrounded by checkpoints, military outposts, closed military zones, and settlements. What is perhaps more disturbing, however, is the fact that one of the chief architects of what is supposed to be a peace deal, Jared Kushner, has direct ties to the funding of an illegal settlement named Beit El, with almost $100,000 that we know about. Kushner is also an open supporter of illegal settlements. Understanding that under Trump's so-called peace plan, settlements will remain in place, I traveled to occupied Al-Khalil, or Hebron as it's called, to meet with local human rights activist Issa Amro to learn more about what the situation would remain as in the heart of the illegal settler conflict zone.
Trump's plan is to make this permanent. Trump's plan is about, you know, legitimizing the settlements and legitimizing this apartheid and segregation and separation and keep me without any basic human rights. They don't want us to film their weakness and their truth. They don't want us to expose that Israel is an apartheid state, Israel is not a democracy, and Israel is not a state of law. It's the state of settlers, soldiers, and it's the state of apartheid and segregation. So the street is closed, all the shops are closed by military orders, and marked as closed shops. Okay, it's marked, sealed, welded as closed shop. It was closed first 1994 after the Ibrahim Moss massacre.
And what justification do they give? Why do they say they have to be closed? Do they give you a justification for closing it?
Always, always. The false justification is security. The main reason for it, it's about confiscation and to have the Arab free zone here. Closing the city center. It's the hub of the city, you know. It's the heart of the city. They closed it and they control it and they drive here. We are not allowed to drive. We are not allowed to drive in our own streets. Our shops are closed. Our houses became empty. They changed the names of the streets from Palestinian Arabic name to Israeli Hebrew names. The road signs are only in English and Hebrew. Israeli flags here, they are taking our identity as Palestinian identity.
And this system right here with the shops closed and everything happening, under Trump's plan, this would remain closed?
It will remain closed. They didn't touch it. They didn't talk about it.
The main entrance to the family is closed. The main road is closed. And we are using the fields to reach the house here. And the family is separated and isolated alone. And the army is occupying the roof. They have a military post on the roof. The family is not allowed to go to the roof.
Yeah.
And they are locked inside the house. And from time to time, the settlers come to the roof, throw stones, throw rocks, throw rubbish to the family without any help. Not only that, the Palestinian ambulance is not allowed to reach here without a special coordination. So you skip all the emergency cases. Mm-hmm. So you are not only sieged by the army and the soldiers, you are seized from any kind of basic human rights.
We continued until we reached a military outpost, where we were at first instructed at gunpoint to go back because Palestinians could not walk on the Jewish-only street there. So we filmed secretly as I asked the soldier present why Issa and my cameraman Hamdi were not able to walk on the road. The soldier I just engaged with refused to speak to me until I told him I was not a Palestinian. But many other soldiers had an even more negative attitude towards us, making it clear that Palestinians or any friends of Palestinians were not welcome. After witnessing the situation in Al Khalil, I then traveled to Ramallah in order to take part in protests rejecting the deal of the century. At this protest you're seeing alone, tens of protesters were shot and many others gassed, causing them to collapse and convulse.
We have an attack here on a member of the press, clearly marked as press. It's of course a violation of international law, firing tear gas everywhere. He passed out unconscious. This man is marked as a press and of course is not protesting. He's here to document purely, and he was targeted by the Israelis.
After the demonstration, we found out following a visit to the Ramallah hospital that four young boys were shot with internationally banned bullets. Three were hit in the legs and one in the head. The protests I witnessed, however, were just the tip of the iceberg. Other demonstrations were much more violent and led to the deaths of several young Palestinians. To find out more about why Palestinian people broke out into mass protest against the deal of the century, I met with the world-renowned journalist Jana Jihad and Palestinian icon Ahed Tamimi, both locals to the village of Nabi Saleh.
So, since the announcement of the so-called
first asking Jana what she had witnessed since the announcement of the Trump plan.
As you said, are getting killed, people are getting arrested. I'm facing checkpoints on my way to school every day. Like, for example, yesterday I was just going to my school, and then there was this checkpoint. You know, the checkpoints here in the West Bank are not checkpoints. They're just a gate on the street. They usually close it, block the street, and then they go. They don't check the car. They just block it. So, like, I had to take another way that takes me about triple the time to get to my school. I was late to my school. Even today, we were stuck for 2 hours on the checkpoint. Every day since the deal of the century had been declared, you know, people, there are a lot of clashes, people are getting killed, people are getting injured, and it's very sad that we are paying the price of something that we didn't cause.
What we heard from Donald Trump was that when this deal was initially announced, that there would be some sort of peace that would come out of this, and that the Palestinians would receive a great amount of money.
I believe that legalizing what's illegal is not peace. Legalizing occupation, legalizing settlements, it's not what we call peace. And I don't care about money. I just want my land. I want to stay in my house. I want to go to the sea that I've never been to, which is only 30 minutes far from my house, that I can literally see every single morning from the roof of my house that I've never been to. That's what I call peace, but that's not peace. And I don't care about money. What if I came and told you I want half of America? I'd pay you, but I just want half of America. Like, what would you do? You would just leave your houses for money, leave your land, leave your life, your memories, your history for money?
In Ramallah, I witnessed the largest demonstration the city had seen since the time of the Second Intifada, or uprising as it is known in English. What was clear to me in the West Bank was that there was a growing sense of desperation and also unity from the Palestinian people that could be felt building day by day. The desperation for action coming from the threat immediately posed to annex areas such as the Jordan Valley, which is where I began to travel to next.
So we've just entered the Jordan Valley here, and what we witnessed just as we were entering was the closed military zones here, and the soldiers in the fields actually aiming just above children and telling them to duck, using them sort of as firing practice. And then what we also discovered as we were driving along is that two Bedouin children, young children who were riding on donkeys, were also arrested by the army.
The Jordan Valley is home to 70,000 Palestinians, yet is 85% inaccessible to its people, as Israel has turned the land into a military training ground and allowed for illegal settlers to come in and make goods to sell around the world. The area is under international law recognized as Palestinian land, which is to be the future agricultural hub of Palestine. Its undeveloped areas could also be used for energy projects, water extraction, and urban centers.
One of the most important things to understand about the Jordan Valley is that this land here constitutes 30% of the West Bank, and of course means the loss of the most fertile agricultural land for a potential future Palestinian state. What you can see straight away when you come here to the Jordan Valley is that the people primarily here are building their houses as tents and as sort of cave structures and things like this, because the Israelis don't allow them here in Area C to actually build, have the permits to build homes. So if they were to actually build proper homes already before the land being annexed, and of course these people inevitably being expelled, then their homes would be bulldozed.
The conditions that have been imposed in the plan says that there is no Palestinian state. So what will happen with us? We are here more than 50% of the population. Now every year they demolish about 500 houses there. This plan says no Palestinian state and no sovereignty, no borders, no water, no air, no underground. Nothing for the Palestinians. In Jordan Valley, we are 70,000 Palestinians, and and the Israeli settlers are only 8,000. So we have to stay, and our existence there will be the main factor to stop the century plan.
It was clear from even before U.S. President Donald Trump, alongside Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, announced the details of the plan that the Israeli regime sought to annex the Jordan Valley, northern Dead Sea, and illegal settlements, throwing away all the progress of work done since 1988 between Palestinians and Israelis. Looking on at the situation on the ground in Palestine, it was clear that a two-state solution looked impossible, and that a one-state solution where Palestinians could live with equal rights to Israelis was a long way from coming to fruition. However, the younger generation of Palestinians served as a great source of hope that one day liberation could perhaps be in sight, and that the failure of the old is now being replaced by a new vision for peace coming from the young.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. In Georgia, United States, Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger is fending off a challenger fueled by Donald Trump's election lies. But do American voters still care about the 2020 as much as the former president does? The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Maya King. The piece is titled, In Georgia, a GOP primary tests the power of a Trump vendetta. An anti-Trump Republican advocacy group recently organized a focus group of GOP voters in Georgia to get their take on perhaps the most competitive and consequential primary election in the state. They heard a lot of indecision. Most of the voters convened by the group, the Republican Accountability Project, knew little about the race between Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's Secretary of State, and his leading challenger, Representative Jody Heiss. Mr. Raffensperger seemed to get the benefit of the doubt until the voters were reminded of the backstory. As the state official responsible for certifying the 2020 presidential election results, Mr. Raffensperger rejected President Donald Trump's attempt to overturn his defeat. Trump then recruited Jody Heiss to seek revenge. "Go Jody, I guess," said one voter in Georgia. 3 out of 6 others agreed. The exchange offered a glimpse into why the Republican primary race for the office that oversees elections remains a dogfight just days from the election day on 24th of May, 2 years after Donald Trump lost Georgia by the slimmest of margins and Democrats captured both of the state's open Senate seats. Wounds from the 2020 presidential election have still not completely healed for some partisans. But marshalling the residual anger to unseat an incumbent is not an easy feat. Brad Raffensperger has worked to win back Republicans by casting himself as a defender of election integrity, even as he has spent hours debunking a laundry list of false claims about the 2020 election. Some voters' memories and passions have faded. Many never had strong opinions about their Secretary of State. It all has made the race one of the purest tests yet of whether the 2020 election lie can be weaponized to win elections. While opinion polls have shown that leagues of Republican voters in Georgia and elsewhere largely embraced the fiction that the 2020 election was stolen in its immediate aftermath, it is not clear those concerns alone or Donald Trump's personal vendetta are enough to drive voters' choices. "I think 2020 was really a turning point in how closely people looked at things," said Sally Grubbs, chairwoman of the Cobb County Republican Party. Before, people might not have even realized that the Secretary of State was in charge of running the elections for the state, but now they're keenly aware of it. Jody Heiss, whom Donald Trump endorsed last year, is one of more than a dozen candidates running for Secretary of State under the America First banner, alongside others in battleground states like Arizona, Michigan, and Ohio. They share an unflinching loyalty to Donald Trump and a belief that the 2020 election was marred. Some are calling for a law enforcement arm to more aggressively prosecute violators of election laws. Opinion polls show large numbers of undecided voters in the race, with Mr. Heiss and Mr. Raffensperger neck and neck, each with about one-third of the vote. Both campaigns are braced for a runoff. Donald Trump's attempt at payback for 2020 in Georgia is floundering in the state's other marquee primary on Tuesday. Former Senator David Perdue, his pick to challenge Governor Brian Kemp after the governor refused to overturn the election results, is trailing Mr. Kemp in opinion polls and fundraising. Donald Trump has hardly weighed in publicly on David Perdue's prospects since hosting a tele-rally for the former senator in April. His former vice president, Mike Pence, is set to visit the state to campaign for Governor Brian Kemp on the eve of the primary election. Mr. Kemp has been adept at using his office to win over skeptical Republicans, passing a slew of conservative policies on elections, law enforcement, and education. For voters still enthralled with false claims of fraud, Governor Brian Kemp can point to the Election Integrity Act of 2021, which limits provisions like ballot drop boxes and mobile voting centers. When voters see that kind of activity around, the concerns they have, it just becomes difficult to drive an argument that people who are in office are being inattentive to the issue, said Brad Alexander, an Atlanta, Georgia-based political consultant and Raffensperger's supporter, who was among several who argued that the potency of the stolen election debate has started to wane. In January, 43% of Georgia Republican voters said they were confident that the November elections would be fair and accurate, according to a University of Georgia opinion poll. By April, that number had increased to nearly 60%, and a record number of voters have already participated in the state's primary elections, topping more than 700,000 voters on the final day of early voting. Jody Heiss, a four-term congressman, was one of the 147 House Republicans who voted against certifying the election results for President Joe Biden. He later took part in a White House meeting alongside Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene to try to determine how the election results could be flipped in Donald Trump's favor. He has claimed falsely that Mr. Trump would have won in Georgia if the election had been fair. At a meeting with the Atlanta Young Republicans on Thursday, 19th of May, Jody Heiss made unsupported claims about ballot harvesting, said he no longer wanted to use Dominion voting machines, and slammed Mr. Raffensperger for sending out unsolicited absentee ballots ahead of the last election. The voice of the people had been violated in 2020, he said. County officials in Georgia identified 64 cases of potential fraud out of the state's roughly 5 million votes in the 2020 election, according to an Associated Press survey of all but 11 of the state's 159 counties. But Mr. Heiss has tried to make his case about more than just 2020, raising the prospect of fraud in the future. This issue is not who wins an election, but the issue is absolutely, was it a fair election, he said. If the election itself is compromised or violated, then all the effort out there really doesn't matter anymore. And that's what we've got to defend. That's what we've got to protect at all costs. Most of the young Republicans in the room said they wanted to hear what Jody Heiss would do differently from Brad Raffensperger in elections, should he be elected. Even if you're not a dogmatic election was stolen person, there are a lot of people with reasonable doubt. And that reasonable suspicion is fair, said Chris Campbell, a 39-year-old national accounts manager at SmartFeeds. Raffensperger didn't address those concerns well, and people don't have confidence in him. But I do have confidence in Jody Heiss and trust that he would run the office with integrity. But there were clear divisions over that conclusion. Questions around the 2020 election, like was it stolen or was it not stolen, aren't healthy, said Alan English, the president of the Atlanta Young Republicans, who remained undecided between the candidates. Looking back at 2020 isn't productive, he said. Many Republicans declared Mr. Raffensperger all but defeated as soon as he announced he would run for re-election, citing Donald Trump's ire and that of many voters. Mr. Raffensperger was censured at a state GOP convention last year, but Donald Trump has been unexpectedly quiet about the race beyond lumping Mr. Raffensperger in with Mr. Kemp in statements railing against what he calls the rhinos, or Republicans in name only, running the state. Sarah Longwell, the founder of the Republican Accountability Project, which conducted the focus group last week, said that Donald Trump's limited involvement could be playing a role in some voters' indecision. Mr. Raffensperger has raised more money than his competitors, courting far-right voters and touting what he calls true conservative values. At an event hosted by the Buckhead Young Republicans, Mr. Raffensperger discussed the 2020 election, but said his office was focused on the real issue of preventing non-citizens from voting. Mr. Raffensperger has called for amending the state constitution to prohibit non-citizens from voting, something that state law already forbids. A state review found no instances of ballots being cast by non-citizens in 2020. Mr. Raffensperger acknowledges that his pitch has done little to pacify some Republicans. "I was never public enemy number one. I just think that some people weren't pleased with the election results," he said. "But in this race here, I'm leaving it to the goodness of my fellow Georgians who stood for the law, made sure that we followed the Constitution and followed the law. And that's all I can do." The roughly 15 people present at the event, mostly 20-something conservatives, were receptive of his message. While some still had concerns about election oversight, they said they appreciated his candor in the face of ongoing attacks. "There wasn't anything that anyone else would have done to do anything," said Bradley Schober, a 27-year-old, an attorney who said he had already voted for Mr. Raffensperger. Ultimately, the guy took as much heat as anybody and came out on the other side standing. Despite the high interest in the showdown, less than $1 million has been spent on television advertising in both the Democratic and Republican primary races for Georgia's Secretary of State, according to Ad Impact, an ad advertisement tracking firm which the candidates exchanging attacks over the outcome of the 2020 presidential election and voting integrity. Jody Heiser's adverts have showcased footage of him and Donald Trump at a rally in Georgia, where the former president called Mr. Raffensperger a rhino and one of the worst Secretary of States in America. Mr. Raffensperger's advertisements have tried to rally Republicans against their common opponent, Stacey Abrams, the Democratic nominee for governor. The group she founded, Fair Fight, sued the state over discriminatory election practices in 2018. The lawsuit is currently in court. When Stacey Abrams attacked Georgia's elections, Jody Heiss did nothing, the advertisement's narrator says. The biggest spender on broadcast television has been Bea Nguyen, the leading candidate in the Democratic primary, who has cast herself as a bulwark against Republican efforts to restrict voting access and meddle in the elections. "When our voting rights are attacked," Ms. Nguyen says in one advertisement, "we all lose."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is your host Zainab. I hope wherever you are, you're fine, you're doing well. And in case you have any problems, you're not doing well. In this holy land, we always pray for your well-being, inshallah. Thank you so much for listening. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we come up with the issues, the problems, the questions that parents have about the upbringing of their children. Well, the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from the Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio with us our guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalafan. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
It's my pleasure.
So today we'll discuss about something that is recommended, that is suggested, that is being said, that if you see youth is getting deviated, especially the Islamic Republic leader Ayatollah Khamenei says, if you feel you're getting deviated as a youth, then try to go to more and more religious gatherings, try to attend them. But as the youth today, we see is avoiding these gatherings. Why? What do you think are the reasons behind?
That's one of the reasons that, you know, youths prevent going to the mosques. It's also a gathering, see?
Yeah.
But they don't like it, maybe because it's too much prolonged, or there are many factors that I'm just going to discuss about.
Yeah.
So in our view, many youths keep away from religious programs due to a number of factors. And I'm going to discuss two of these factors that are the most important ones. So first of all, there's a poisonous kind of propaganda that, people have unleashed on our younger people for a very long time. The youth.
True.
That this has made them suspicious of our religious gatherings in the first place. And our spirituality.
Yeah.
Okay, as a whole. Because the facts are presented to them in a distorted manner. What facts? How are these facts presented? Through the speaker, the lecturer of the mosque.
All right.
So they are distorted. There's no systematically order in, to guide the youths.
All
sometimes
right.
Sometimes you see a speaker come, he just talk, things that are so haywirely discussed. And the youth does not like that because maybe he's an educated youth and he would like to go in a systematic order. And sometimes he gets so confused, hearing from one law to another law that have, are unfamiliar to each other. And he feels, why this kind of conflict between the two?
And unfortunately, we have, it's very unfortunately late that we have some scholars today who try to start their lectures with a very, very long khutbah, with a very, very lengthy khutbah, which at the very first distorts the youth. They're like...
Khutbah, right?
Yeah, they're like kind of fed up, like, I know how long khutbah you have memorized and all. So, because youth is not going to take that all. So, yes, there are certain reasons, I agree.
Yes, yes. So the way you recite the khutbah, as you said, yeah, you pointed out something important. I agree with you that... to that too, like, don't prolong something in such a way with lots of Arabic words to make the person feel that you don't know anything, I know it all.
Yeah.
Right? So this you intimidate the youth. You feel that I don't know anything, so what for? Like, I'm coming, I'm not understanding even the Arabic bit. So a small khutbah could be a good start. And also somebody who has the good information to give. And also, these days, the youths need to be inspired more than they need to be pumped up with information.
All right.
So a person might have so much to say, and all are logical experiences, but they don't have the spirituality.
True.
Youths need that emotional spirituality too, because they have the information.
Yes.
They have these days the media, and there's so many sites that they can go to, and their books are all there, and they have so many groups that they could ask their questions to. But they kind of know the answers, but they need to be inspired.
Yeah, we have so many narrations from Imam Sadiq alayhisalam and Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, wherein they say that it's the youth actually who has the better ever ground to accept all the spirituality.
Asset.
Like, no one other than youth has that beautiful ground to accept all that. I'll be talking to you, sister, here. We need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. And we are talking about why youth avoid religious gatherings. Sister, you were saying.
Yes, this was the first main important thing that, you know, like the way the information is portrayed, in what way, like the way you mentioned, the khutbah might be too long, or maybe the whole lecture might be too long and boring. Maybe it's so dry. Philosophical issues, which is not what the youth want, because when we are considering a lecture of everyone together, the youth, the child, the old, everyone together, so everybody needs that their share of knowledge that they can even like take something with them, like a risk, a sustenance, a risk ma'anawi, something to improve by, right? Especially in the days of Muharram, the sacred days of Muharram. So we should select a speaker to inspire more than to just give information, dry information. And also, we should note the fact that when the speaker is speaking, he should not prolong his speech in such a way that the youth get bored. You know, the Holy Prophet used to give a lecture of only 30 minutes, it said. Only 30 minutes, or some say even 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Not more than that, because the brain capacity can take that much, and after that it gets tired and bored.
Yeah.
And when it takes that much and it applies, it's better than when you hear twice as much, and which is more informative, even if it is more inspirational, but you can't take everything.
All
your mind gets so exhausted. Unless, of course, it's a class which certain people come with all their intention to receive something, to receive the Islamic knowledge. So that's different. But when a lecture is conducted, it should have this kind of rules.
True.
Another factor is that due to the effect that young people are so much distanced by programs of, you know, these kind of gatherings and going to the mosques and everything, is because of the lack of attention in Islamic principles itself.
All right.
You see that big man will start talking and joking and laughter in Shahadat days. So a youth will begin to wonder that I've come to board here, but look at these people. They're laughing. They're talking about their businesses.
All right.
They're not even paying attention. Or you see somebody rudely behaving. Don't take this. Take only one. For example, if they're giving the tabarruk.
All right.
No, take. Oh, no pushing, no pushing. Oh, you're pushing me. You know, this thing kind of puts off the youth. So they should be an organized manner in such a way that these programs ought to be conducted for a youth to be inspired.
All right.
Yeah. That when we go there, there's so much organization. Everybody gets with respect the tabarruk. For example, people behave so much with etiquette. Everybody is ready to give space to you when you come. Not that you are a youth, go. There's no space here. You can go.
In the Quran,
when it says when somebody
sometimes
comes, you know,
make
space for them. So these kind of things put off the youth.
So
these are the main things, among other things, that I believe that puts them off from attending.
So you're actually saying that it's our conduct that also matters, the way we behave in these gatherings. Well, I'll be talking to you on that note. Here, we need to take another break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio. I have Sister Salma Khalfan with me, who is talking on the topic why youth avoid religious gatherings. Sister, you said that like we have narrations like our Ahlul Bayt, may peace be upon them, say that in case you are our followers, you are our Shias, when you are happy, in our happiness, when you are sad, in our sadnesses. But you said if there is a mourning,
if there's some martyrdom anniversary and we are mourning, and you see these people, they are laughing stocks over there, and they are talking about business and other stuff, or they are avoiding them. We start our majalis, we start our lectures with the name of Prophet, who was himself, peace be upon him and his family, known for his akhlaq, for his ethics, for his morals and values. So where else do you think we are lacking that these youth get get repelled from these gatherings?
Another factor might be is because, for example, gathering, one place of gathering which is of ultimate recommendation and beauty is the mosque of praying Jamaat Namaz.
All right.
The Salat of congregation.
Congregation,
right?
Prayers.
So when they go there, they see the Imam of the Jamaat praying so slowly.
Yeah.
And that puts them off. That here I can finish my prayer within 10 minutes.
Yeah.
This comes at a later, as you get acquainted with the prayers and you get an interest. So, you know, you can't take a youth by force that, no, pray slowly. At least he prays. That's a big thing.
Yeah.
Then you explain the philosophy of prayers and everything. Very rarely youth are like that. And it's a very special quality for youth has that capability to pray slowly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they will come due to their own desire. But if people are encouraging, parents are encouraging their child to go to gatherings, then mostly the mosques should enhance that there's an Imam Juma who's so lively and good-charactered and ready to, you know...
Energetic.
Yeah, and ready to attract the youth through his namaz, which is proper, not fast, but not slow either. And when he even recites his dua, he doesn't prolong his dua in such a way it makes the youth feel, look at his time or the pages that are left for the dua to finish. For example, Dua Kumail. You know, usually we feel that this is one chance of forgiveness on Thursday nights.
Yeah.
So we encourage our children, let's go to the haram, let's go. But you see, many children, they feel it's just not ending. You see, it's just not ending. I'd rather read it myself. And they're right in a way. They don't have that capacity to sit for that long. We as adults even sometimes can't. So
all
what
right.
of children, right? So yeah, shorten the gatherings of Azadari as well.
Right.
When Doha is being recited, there'll be about 8, 10 Dohas.
All right.
It's two Dohas with heartfelt, you know, spirituality and like
heartfelt
feelings.
Spirituality is quantity matter.
Quality matters,
Quantity does not matter.
Exactly.
It's quality that matters.
Even one Doha.
Yeah.
You know, you can never ever mourn enough for Imam Hussein.
Alayhi salam.
So even 1-2 Dohas are enough. And then you give them Tabarruk.
However, that should be heartfelt.
Yeah, and that's why people, you know, they feel that there's no use to go to the mosque. The Tabarruk is got at 12. And then you see people coming for Tabarruk instead of the real Tabarruk, which
the
is
real
tabarruk of the soul,
yes,
right?
Exactly. Thank you so much, sister, for being with us. Thank
You're
you
welcome.
So much. And thank you so much for these beautiful points that we, as seminary students and so many imams, need to take care of to attract the youth, actually, not to repel them from their religious gatherings. Inshallah, may Allah increase our capabilities to attend these gatherings more and more. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. To listen to that session again, you can go back to our website, parstoday.com, Good Call of Islam. Email us your questions as well at the email englishradio@irib.ir. And in case you want to follow us on the social media platforms, you can just search Call of Islam Radio and you can find programs there. Thank you so much for listening. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio,
Coming up is the news.